Sharks MTG podcast back, fresh after the recent pro tour. And I'm joined by my regular co-host, Kalyan Petkov. Kalyan, how are you doing, pal?
Hey, Karan, doing well. Excited to be here. We have a very special guest today. So, yeah, let's get it going.
Yeah, very special indeed. Lots of you might have heard, you've definitely heard of the name Mogged from the MTGO streets, a man who's been terrorizing everyone on that platform for the last few years, and otherwise known as Haris Kikiris. Haris, welcome to the show.
Hello, guys. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's a privilege to have you here, especially after your breakout performance at the Pro Tour, which we'll get into a little bit later. But first and foremost, for people who, you know, want to get to know about you and your story, you know, your entry point to Magic, is it safe to say Magic Online, was it? Or were you sort of a paper kitchen countertop Magic player? How did you get into Magic?
I started playing paper Magic back in 2013. I won the, at the time it was called like the Click Qualifier or something for the national team. Like, we had the World Cup tournament, which was the best tournament in Magic's history, by the way, that teams would face off each other, like, from each country. So that was my breakout to competitive Magic, playing this tournament. After that, I joined Magic Online, and yeah, like, I left Pepper, and then COVID came, and then the Pro Tour was announced back, and then I started to get back into it.
Right. So which, you said 2013, was that the year that you were there? Would that have been Nice?
Oh, no, I won in 2015. So. Yeah, like, my breakout to competitive Magic was like 2015, but I did Modo ever since. And now, like, I'm pursuing the solo path of the Pro Tour, I guess. Yeah.
Cal, were you? I think I was definitely there in 2015 as well. I can't remember which one it was, but, you know, getting old and all of this. But yeah, you're right. Absolutely right. The World Magic Cup was by far the best. And Cal, you also played in the old world, right? Like, safe to say the World Magic Cup was the best experience for you as well?
I mean, yeah, it's great because there's like a lot of camaraderie. There's a lot of national pride. But I think maybe the reason for me why it was the best was because we had the opportunities to play abroad and, you know, competitively on the world stage was so few and far between back then. So I think that's probably why it really stands out, you know, aside from maybe one what used to be Pro Tour qualifier per season for our country, you know, nationals and worlds, and then later on the World Magic Cup were always the highlights. But yeah, I was on a brief hiatus. So actually my only hiatus in Magic, and just came back 2015. So by the time Fate Reforged came out, so yeah, I have a sense of when this was.
Yeah, and if I stand to be corrected, Haris, but I know it's similar. I think that the Greece Magic scene, again, being a little further away from sort of the Magic hub of sort of far Western Europe, and a lot more opportunities, a lot of PDQs in places like Italy and, you know, those bigger, historically bigger Magic regions. I know a lot of Turkish players as well. And I know that you guys face similar sort of challenges and can relate to what Cal's saying about limited opportunities in paper. I guess, is that a reason why it drove you to Magic Online?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Like, the GPs seemed like hard to access from a financial like standpoint. There was like too much to pay for accommodation and tickets to be worth it to play the event and like pursue this in a like professional competitive way. So Magic Online seemed like an easier way to play into tournaments and compete for like some cast or whatever. Some Greeks did it, but I think it was like a hobby and not so much of a professional path. So yeah, you're absolutely right that that affected things back then.
And as far as Magic today for you, would you say at this point you're pursuing it with a professional mindset? Are you looking to do this full time?
Yeah, I guess I'm looking to do this full time. And Pro Tour path is like a very good opportunity because you get to like cover some expenses by winning like the RCQ, then doing well at the RC. Like, I think the path is better suited for this kind of thing than the Grand Prix ever was in the past.
And as far as where you are in your life now, you know, you're a young guy. How long have you been doing this magic thing in the context of your life?
I've been doing this like semi-professionally for the last 8 years, but every year I'm all more lean into it and spending more and more time into magic.
May I ask how old you are right now?
Yeah, I'm 30 years old right okay. now. Yeah.
Cool.
So I couldn't help but notice, was I went to, I just tried to find some sort of info on you beforehand. And as you say, because you've been doing magic online for such a long time, the bulk of information comes on Magic Online. And I noticed a few years back, if I go back to like 2015 or 2016, I think, a lot of your results were commander, competitive commander sort of leagues and stuff. What's up with that? Is it just something you really enjoyed, or was it something you thought you could just get a lot of equity out of by grinding commander leagues?
Well, it's both. Like, it was good with equity, but it was also the best format I've ever played. I still think it's the best format I've ever played till today. If you guys can get allow me to have like a short parenthesis and talk about this. Okay. So, Commander Wagwan is like a singleton format that is basically like similar to Legacy in a way. But also has the commander. It's the extra thing. Like, you play all the card pool from Legacy as one-offs, and then the commander fills your empty turns. So you can build your deck in a way that you will never flood or like screw, in a, like the classic stuff Magic players complain about. So commander like actually fills those voids, and you will always get to play the game. It's more like chess, and it leads to like huge games of magic that go about like 30 turns, and like you have to answer the commander and find an answer and not miss, find a land and not stumble in any spot and think like 5 turns ahead. It's like very, very deep, and it's like one game that lasts as long as 3 games, but it's so intense.
Yeah, I think what it immediately reminded me of was Battle Box, if you've ever played that. It's like a limited format where you can choose where you draw either lands or spells. And then you can like pick one of the 10 enemy or friendly dual lands that enter the battlefield tapped as like your source of mana. So you can either draw from a stack of, you know, powerful creatures and spells, or a dual land. And then in that sense, you have to plan ahead. Okay, what colors of mana am I going to need? My lands are going to be entering tapped, you know, this kind of thing. So yeah, that's very interesting. I hadn't considered that 1v1 commander would be a good magic format, you know, so very cool.
Yeah, I hope they bring it back because they announced like they're going to make commander a thing. I really hope they bring back 1v1 commander, because that's the best format I've ever played.
Yeah, I can just see into the future. Mugged wins the 1v1 commander challenge on the Saturday. I can just see it coming up. That's interesting, man. Like, yeah, we've never considered that. And you know, it just most, and it's interesting to get your perspective, because most people who are into competitive magic typically frown upon EDH, you know, or commander. They don't usually want to play commander for, you know, because of, I guess, the traditional setting. And as you say, maybe the 1v1 the 1v1 aspect of it is very different, because it removes the politics of, oh, I must, you know, who am I going to attack? Can I be nice to this person so they don't kill me and all that nonsense, you know?
No, so, yeah. No, it's definitely not like that. Like, it looks more like a super competitive format like Legacy than the rest of Commander, I guess.
Okay, like, well, maybe. I think maybe you need to coach Cal and I to teach us about competitive commander at some point. Harris, so you get into MTGO, you start finding your niche, your formats that you enjoy. Initially, as you say, it's a lot of that 1v1 commander. Would you say that you have a format that you sort of fancy, your favorite format, or does it not matter? Is it whatever the competitive format is for you? What is your preference?
It definitely matters. I hate playing Pioneer for like an important tournament. I guess Modern similar. I like playing Standard and Popper usually. Standard is by far the best. Like, unless they have a huge problem like Oko, it always ends up being super interesting. Because midrange is usually the best in these formats. So you will have a very nice metagame developed around that. And you will have a lot of deck building decisions and long games that really test your prowess compared to something like Pioneer, which has all these decks that win on turn 5, and you have to, like, it's like the modern of all time, where you used to have like lots of combo decks, and you had to like devote sideboard slots to fight off specific things, and you can't really protect yourself against the metagame. You will always concede some matchups and like feel lucky when matched against something else. It's not very in your control, Pioneer. So Standard is the best, I think, and Popper is okay, and then Pioneer is the worst.
That's an interesting observation. Usually when I hear people complain, especially on Twitter, people complain about Pioneer and they say, it's a play draw format. And if you're on the draw, there's almost nothing you can do and you're going to lose, which I generally disagree with that comment. But I think the interesting observation that you made is that matches tend to be quite swingy and you need to dedicate a lot of sideboard slots to solve particular bad matches. Do you think perhaps that's a reason why something like the red-black midrange deck is so popular? Because it's customizable. And in essence, you've got the answers to beat almost anything in the format, right? Like, apart from maybe the extreme decks that go way over the top of you, generally, you've got the tools, you customize your list, and your list can be tuned to beat anything. Is that maybe the reason why the deck's so popular and seems to do well in Pioneer?
Yeah, sure. I agree with that. It's a very good, it's one of the few decks that Pioneer has in that archetype, I guess. Even blue-white control feels like it's less of a control than red-black is right now. Red-black can probably have good matchup with most decks if it chooses to with the cyber slots.
So a question for you regarding like the texture of these formats. You mentioned you like Pauper for similar reasons that you like Standard, but I would argue there's like a wide variety of archetypes in Pauper that, you know, can be competitive. You have big mana, you have some combo decks, you have really low to the ground aggro. In the case of Burn, has some of the best Burn spells ever printed available in that format. So, yeah, there's like a wide range of decks. Is it because the meta game really condenses come challenge time and you don't expect people to bring, you know, some of these archetypes, and as a result, you're able to dedicate more slots to what you're expecting? Why would you group Pauper into the same, realm as Standard in this case?
Yeah, that's a fair question. I should probably have got more into that. I think Pauper right now is in a terrible spot, like right now. But most of the time, for most of its history, Fairies was the number one deck, and that was always a nice time to play Pauper, because it kind of reminded me of like a format with a midrange deck on the top, and then the aggro decks being a bad choice into that, and then you have some decks that try to go over the top, and it's like grindy, and you play a lot of turns, and aggro is sometimes correct, but not always correct. So it was very interesting, and right now it's probably the worst that's ever been, but I think it's going to get fixed. That's what usually happens to Pauper.
For our listeners and maybe other people that aren't as clued in to Pauper, why or what is it that you don't like about it right now?
Well, the issue is Affinity has basically saved the entire format, and Burn is like too good of an aggro deck that it can have like 50-50 matchups with everything. So instead of being incentivized to make a good control list or try to contain these things, you just have to do a more proactive strategy and try to find your wins that way.
Okay. And if you you know, had a say in how to correct the format's issues right now, how would you go about doing that? Is it just a nerf to burn? Is it as simple as that? Or do you think there would be another kind of problem deck as a result of doing so?
I think, I don't think there would be a big problem deck. It's Affinity is probably the hardest to beat. So if you take care of that and then take some power away from burn, like a big kind of reset, I think it's going to be so interesting as long as we have like a steady deck on top. Like, a variety of slower decks.
Yeah, some like popular decks keeping the format in check or keeping people honest. Okay, I have a sense of what you mean.
Yeah.
Isn't this the nature, though, of sort of your eternal formats, whether it's Pauper, Modern, whatever the case is? Eventually, more and more cards get printed into said formats, and it pushes the boundaries and starts fracturing what you enjoy about a format, right? Like, isn't that is just the nature of it, and isn't it inevitable? And maybe it speaks again to, if that is the case, and if I'm not mistaken, then that would always argue against those eternal formats and make, you know, leave standard to be that one format that has the best room. Cal?
Yes, I don't want to steal Harris's thunder, too. He has a strong opinion with regards to this question, but I think in Pauper, this is definitely like the most evident anytime they introduced any, you know, legacy mechanics. So in the case of the last, I think it was Commander Baldur's Gate, when we got the dungeon, it was very evident, and, you know, a lot of changes had to come about a very short time after the introduction of that set. But I think as far as making changes, like Harris was suggesting, you know, you do have a very invested player base, but making those changes is not going to be as devastating to them financially as, you know, other eternal formats like Modern or Legacy, where, you know, you ban Oko and now, well, I've had to go and acquire, you know, Tropical Islands for my deck that I wouldn't otherwise have gotten, or what have you. But in the case of Pauper, you know, you rebalance burn, maybe someone can move laterally and play like a red black madness or something like that. But Harris, please go ahead.
Like, the last additions to Pauper were really devastating. Initiative and Storm, I think, are the latest things they included into the format. And not by choice. It's probably just like random after effects of the sets they released. And this will be a problem because this will happen more often. And I don't know how to fix this unless they directly include Pauper into the formats they think about when they're printing a new set.
Could it be as simple as something like the commander products, you know, not making commander products legal in Pauper? Because that, from what you say, it sounds like that's where some of the biggest problems with the initiative and that sort of thing being a challenge.
Yeah, I really don't know what the fix is like. But I'm pretty sure if they had someone who enforces some Pauper like protection, they could probably get around it.
I think you just found the name of your first podcast, Pauper Protection by Mog.
Yeah, I think we found the name of this episode as well. Okay, I think it sounds clear that you're very passionate about Pauper, and yeah, I know Cal is as well. Hence, he's prodding a lot of these questions. I think so. You're in it. You're in the streets. The grind is part of your life, as you say. You've been doing this for years now. What changed? Because there's a tweet in December. There's a tweet in December by you where you say, well, this is the year I'm going to pursue pro paper play. What changed in you that made you say, okay, I'm taking it from MTGO streets to wanting to make it to the top of pro Magic? What was that tipping point for you, or what led to that decision?
I guess what happened is I was ready before, but there was COVID and everything. And actually getting to the arena how do they call it? Like, arena championships was kind of hard. Like, I never really understood most of the ways you get there. So the moment paper started, I somehow missed the first one. I don't know why. But then I realized, oh, this is like such a good tournament. It has, it incentivizes you to play competitively. So I'm just going to do this.
Right. So I guess, and that's where, am I right in saying, then you went for the qualifiers to play the RC in Naples. Am I right? Is that where your journey started?
Yes. I basically won an RCQ and then went straight to Naples. And that's where it started. Yes.
Yeah. And if I remember correctly, it didn't start too well. Right? Like you had a really bad start. I think weren't you like 2-2 after four rounds in Naples or something?
Yeah. I was 2-2. I thought it's near impossible to make it now, but I'm going to keep playing anyway. And I went with 6-3 on day two. And I basically had a very good run. And in the end, like the last round, I can basically get in with an ID, and like everyone around me has submitted IDs, and I'm the only one sitting on the table and waiting for my opponent, and my opponent is taking like a 10-minute bathroom break, and he comes back and he wants to play, so like the entire season like having like a plot twist ending, but I managed to get there. And I was happy about it.
Yeah, and I imagine quite frustrating because as you say, if you lose that round, you probably miss out on the invite to the pro tour. And like all you need to do is handshake, take the ID, and you're both qualified. And unfortunately, or at the time it seemed unfortunately, Elliot, a friend happens to be a friend of mine, and for whatever reason, renowned deck builder had other ideas and wanted to play. But it worked out.
Yeah, it worked out. Like, I was very glad to see his list because I thought I had a really good matchup. So that, like, rallied me back into the game.
Yeah, I remember he played, like, a crazy deck with that dragon that cast spells from the graveyard with the cost reduction and, you know, one of the classic Elliot Brew decks, as always. I mean, in fact, when we went, I think when Cal and I won the World Magic Cup as well, he gave us the deck for our team as well, one of those cycling decks at the time. But yeah, great deck builder. But yeah, I'm glad it worked out. So you get the result. You qualified for the Pro Tour, finally. And there's a funny tweet, and just for people who don't know, they I think you're a great follow. People need to follow you on Twitter, and maybe you can plug your Twitter handle a bit later. But there's a Twitter a post that you made. Someone tweeted, you tweeted, oh, split the finals of the standard challenge. And then someone replied something along the lines of, yeah, you're lucky that Jabberwocky wasn't there. It was always at the Pro Tour. And you replied, no, they're all lucky that I'm not at the Pro Tour, which I thought was hilarious. And as it transpired, by evidence on this past weekend, you're absolutely right because you did exceptionally well. Can you take us through, like, Pro Tour and your preparation for the Pro Tour? Are you very much one of these people that, you know, does your own thing, or do you work in a team?
I worked in a team for this Pro Tour. My process was to, first of all, root out the bad decks, I guess, and then focus on stuff we already know. We thought for this one, brewing would probably be hard to do because there was so little time, and I don't think the team was big enough to support this. So we just focused on what we knew and like based our deck building on the previous metagame. In the end, I think the team thing is very time consuming, and I have not learned yet how to work in a team. So it seemed to me that it's better if I keep doing this on my own, but maybe it's because I don't have any experience, and maybe like someone will teach me how to be more efficient with teamwork.
Yeah, and I think that's something that, like, you know, the dynamic, understanding the people that you're working with. Have you worked with them before? Do you know how they work? It takes time to bond and understand, you know, people. You know, there's some people who are really smart and you can be in a team with them, but they say very little, or they maybe don't have the right ways of sharing their ideas. And then conversely, you get some people who are really loud and just have these hot takes, you know, even though they're not really sure what they're saying and can put points across with confidence. So it's really an interesting balance. And I guess that's where over time, finding the right group of people to work with probably can be beneficial.
Do you find that, you know, it's maybe challenging to you or not as fruitful as you would like because you tend to be the idea person and, you know, you're having to convince others of why something is good? Or is it because everybody's going in different directions and it's hard to kind of bring it back in and really narrow in on something specific that's, you know, the right thing to be doing? So it's kind of maybe hurting your confidence in a sense because people are maybe pulling you away from what you think is good. And then, you know, in your mind, inevitably it wasn't worth it because you believe that your strategy is the way to go.
Well, I think my team in this case was like very open to my ideas and very supportive. It's just that I think it takes a lot of time to be in a team and like run a team because I was like head of standard in a way. So it's like so much time to write down stuff, talk about everyone's ideas and instead like just jumping games on leagues would be more beneficial. Like, I'm not sure where the correct line is. Like, I don't know, but it felt like very, very time consuming. And you have to go do all this non-magic stuff in a team that to me, it seemed like I was doing better before, but that's probably because of my inexperience of running a team.
So specifically the non-magic related things, is this like coordinating people and, you know, maybe doing things outside of the scope of being, you know, quote unquote head of standard? So where you want to be dedicating time to playing games and, you know, learning the intricacies of a matchup or how to sideboard, you having to do a lot more facilitating, like, you know, maybe presentations for the other players and having to argue with them, you know, for or against something?
Yeah, definitely expressing myself was the hardest part of this. Like, how do I put into words what I think about the standard and how to convince others, how to make my points clear. And it's when someone has a different idea, you have to use like other like skills and get it into their world a little bit. And I don't think I was good in doing this thing.
So when you were playing, and as far as like the actual preparation goes, would you be, you know, like you said, jamming leagues and then have players from your team maybe watching you on Discord at the same time so you guys can see it in real time as things happen? You know, this is the critical turn for this matchup. You know, I'm not going to be baited to go down, you know, in this direction or commit to this line because I know that this is a way that this match is lost, etc. Like, is that how you were doing it? Or were you independently playing and then saying, listen, guys, this is my build of Black Red, this is my build of Grixis, and then having to kind of start from scratch, so without them having seen it or without them having put in the games to really be able to understand in depth like your point or where you're coming from?
I probably should have done more of the first thing of playing leagues and talking through lines, but instead it was a little bit more chaotic than that. So I don't think I found the way by just making threads and playing matchups and just pairing people and hoping to get conclusions. Yeah,
I think especially when your approach to something is radically different to, I guess, the convention, getting people to buy into that can be quite challenging. So, for example, your deck list and your approach prior to this in the Grixis Mirrors was always taking out the Invoke Despairs, right? Like, that was the plan even at Naples, siding out. And people thought that was crazy. I mean, whoever I played against, good players, you know, no one would cut their Invoke Despairs. Maybe they'd trim it or something along those lines, but they thought that was the most important card in the matchup. And here you are coming in with a plan of, you know what, I'm not going to just sideboard these cards in. I'm not going to include it in my list. And on top of that, I'm cutting Shieldreds as well, where other people are looking to go up to threes and fours. You stayed down at two. So, yeah, and as Cal highlights, some people were even bringing in the fourth copy of Invoke. So when you come out with such a radical point of view, how is that received, and how was that received amongst your team? Did the team sort of go with that approach? Did they all agree and cut the Invokes? Because I imagine that's a really difficult sell when the average person can't understand why you're doing it.
Well, my team was running Hidetsugu, but when I explained the idea of cutting Invokes, I think they agreed. We didn't end up playing that deck. We ended up playing like four or five of us played Hidetsugu. Me and Danilakos, Frank, we played Grixis Talk, and then two other people played Esper Legends. But I think they were all very understanding of my ideas and agreeing with me in that in how the matchup should be played.
Because it's insane. Let me tell you, the first time when you told me like, oh no, just cut the Invokes, cut whatever. We're cutting the Shieldreds, we're cutting the Invokes. It's like, okay, so wait, I'm playing this deck and I need to cut, you're telling me I need to cut all the best cards in the matchups. You know, the only good one I'm leaving in is Fable. Like it, you know, until you actually play it and then you see how the game goes. And I think Cal made a point when he, you know, a while ago when we were looking at Standard. It's almost like you approach it as a fish deck, you know? You load to the ground, cheap interactive spells, whether it's counter spells, removal, discard, cheap threats, and other people are trying to play these expensive over-the-top, and you just go underneath, which I think is just brilliant. And the little bit I managed to catch off coverage, that's all the commentators could speak of, where they were like, well, this is the guy with no invokes. They just couldn't believe that you weren't playing invokes. Like, what, you know, I missed your interview with Cedric. What did he have to say about you not playing invokes?
He asked me why I have no invoke. He probably expected like a better answer, but I told him it's probably a mistake because in that metagame, I should probably have been running invokes. I think in Naples, running invokes and then cutting it was the best thing you could do against the Grixis. But in this metagame, I should probably be running more invokes because they're still good against Red Black. They're still good against Atraxa. They're still good against Grixis game one, at least. So I guess it was like a misread of me. I should probably have a more stock list for this tournament specifically.
Yeah, and that's fair. And that's something that we spoke about because when the Red Black decks first started breaking out, and Cal was playing the RC in the US, San Diego, right, Cal? And that was our thing. And we said, okay, well, because they can't counter, the red-black deck can't counter your invoke, it's safe to tap out and play this five-mana spell.
Yes.
So it made sense. So that was our plan, to keep in all the invokes against that against the red-black deck. So we thought it was really good. But it's interesting that you say you think it was probably a mistake. I guess in hindsight, given how the metagame turned out and the matchups and the decks that you saw there.
So my idea was, this is kind of an open metagame, slightly. Like, there's going to be a little bit more aggro than there was at the Pro Tour. That's my idea. Like, there's going to be a little bit more aggro, like more Esper Legends, maybe some more red deck, because more red has some new additions. More like a random new deck, like either mid-range or control. But there was none of that. There was like a low percentage of, 12% Esper Legends, and that was the only deck I could prey upon with not having invokes, basically. And the moment I saw the metagame, I'm like, okay, like my deck is not super well positioned, but I did think Grixis, as far as the archetype, was the best deck for this tournament because you would have like a slightly bad red-black matchup and be good against Atraxa way more than red-black is because of the counters. Yeah, so in the end, like I was still happy, but I wish I was playing Stock Grixis with invokes.
So how were you able to find success, you know, given that you know, in your mind, you don't think you went with the best version of the deck for the tournament? Was it, you know, the usual combination of good play with some luck and, you know, in terms of how you drew, which matchups you got paired up against, ultimately having finished ninth, I think 11-4-1 or whatever it was. How did that come together?
I was lucky in limited, I think is the first thing. I drafted a mono red deck that was a pretty good deck, but not for a 3-0. I during my second round, my opponent had an insane deck, but I somehow drew like very well and beat my opponent, which was like a win I probably shouldn't get. And then I'm in the 2-0 bracket against Carl Sharap, Teribad, and he has the worst 2-0 deck I've ever seen. Like, he even tells me, like, I don't know how I got 2-0 with this deck. So my deck's a little better than his, and I managed to get the 3-0, but it's like two coincidental things that helped me. So Limited was lucky day one, and then I do think I was really well prepared for Standard. Like, I knew all the sequences. So I had a 7-3 record in Standard. I don't think that was too lucky. That was probably, like, in my expectations. But Limited is the big thing, I guess, which I'm not a good drafter compared to most of the top Pro Tour players.
So just taking a step back as far as like the macro standpoint for this Pro Tour, you said, you know, before we actually started recording that, you know, having been your first Pro Tour, there were a lot of things you noticed. So, you know, you're experiencing it for the first time. You have a lot of takeaways. You want to share some of those with us?
Sure. So paper tournaments are really different. I didn't know it was going to be 13 hours of playing or something. It was very long. So endurance is really important in these tournaments. I start getting like very, very tired in the later rounds. And like day two, okay, so day two, I woke up sick because you had a terrible pizza the last night. So I was like throwing up, and I had slept like no hours. And I played my first round, and I completely messed it up. I played so bad that first round. I get a draw. It should have been a win. In the end, like that's the round that defined my Pro Tour. But you know, that's all in hindsight. So it's like the physical things that are attached to the Pro Tour, and you can't just like zoom out and play online and like just take care of your chess clock and be in your comfort zone. I don't have these things in paper, and those are like big disadvantages to me that other players are more experienced with.
There's a couple of things that you said there, and the one I want to touch on is paper play, the transition to paper play. So when you, as you say, you go Magic Online, there's complexity with playing Magic Online, but there are also some easy things where, you know, you cast your Blood Tide Harvester, the token comes into play. You cast your whatever it is, the tokens automatically appear. Where in paper, it's a simple thing. You know that the card does this, but it's very easy to mess up that mechanic of not putting the blood token in play, not putting a treasure token in play. Like, how much concentration or how much did you find that being a challenge just to remember these little things that online platforms just automatically do for you?
I guess that takes like, this is like having less RAM, like less memory devoted to this thing in Magic Online. But when you're in paper, you have to take away some of your focus to do all this stuff. And I hadn't played since Naples. I hadn't played paper since Naples. Maybe like one time in the LGS, but it, you know, it's something you have to get used to, and it diverts away your focus unless you're like a pro at that thing. Because there's so many things. Like, it seems it's just one blood token, but no, you have to like do like all the phases and like many triggers and pass priority and like communicate everything. It's different.
Would you have done something different to prepare yourself for paper play? Was there something like going into the next major event, Pro Tour, whatever the case is that you're playing, would you do something differently in order to make sure you are more prepared and, you know, you're going, you know, better space, you're more practiced with the paper mechanics hitting in? What would that be?
I would do 1 week of bootcamp with my team and play every game, every day in paper, of course. We only had 2 days. That like 2 days were probably the best 2 days in my preparation. They gave me so much equity those 2 days. If I had a week, it would be so much better. Specifically for me, who the thing I'm lacking is like paper experience.
Yeah, fair enough. And I imagine, as I say, I had a similar sort of experience recently when I, before Naples, I haven't played Paper Magic for the longest time, and dumb things like forgetting tokens and all these kind of things kept on happening because, you know, you just weren't doing it. And now that I've started playing Paper Magic again, it's second nature. So yeah, absolutely. I think it's something you can benefit from. And the last thing, the other thing you mentioned earlier, when you're talking about the drafts, you know, it gives me that example I always tell people. The last Pro Tour I played at, in fact, I practiced with the Frenchies, with Raph Levy and with Elliot. And at the time, in the sort of house we were at, I was killing it on Magic Online, you know, lots of drafts and whatever the case is. The time the Pro Tour comes along, I don't do well in the draft, and Raph just casually I think he 6-0'd the draft or whatever, like, you know, no problem. No, you know, just some of these guys have been doing it for such a long time and at such a high level. It really takes a lot of work to be able to compete at that level consistently. And I guess for most people, the draft element is the one that becomes where you need to put a bit extra work and to get it to that level. So back to we're done with your one draft. You go on to the rest of Standard, and you have a strong day, as you say, in Standard, and you finish 7-1?
7-1, 3-0 in Limited, and 4-1 in Standard.
Right. And that was, unfortunately, as you say, not a great night, weren't feeling well, probably led to you playing poorly and throwing away a win early on. And so how does the rest of that draft unfold?
I play round 2 against Javier. We are on the same green-white deck, which is probably a mistake from my side, because I had passed the green white counter scout. Like, I had signaled that this is open, but I ended up in that deck because I tried to stay open, but then I didn't feel there's any other path in pack 2, so I defaulted back to a deck that's already been played on the table, and it's like a very medium deck, like a 4 or a 5 out of 10 deck. So I'm just hoping to get like 2-1, but in the end I get 1 win, 1 loss, and 1 tie, which was okay from that deck.
So then you would be, I guess, 9.5 after 12 rounds?
Yes, and during the third round of the draft, Carl and Nathan choose to ID. So I haven't done the math, but I think, well, if they think an ID is getting in, then that's good for me, because I might just need to 3-2 Standard and get in, which I ended up doing. I ended up 3-2ing the Standard, but no loss, no tie, no 11-4-1 got in the top 8. So I guess they were wrong, and yeah.
Right, so you got the 3-2, as you're pointing out, you got the 3-2 in the remainder of Standard, and you finished with what, 34 points for 9th place? Is that right?
Yes,
34 points, and so to 8 was, as you say, was a win. You needed one more win, essentially.
Yeah, I need one more.
36. Okay, Cal.
Okay, yeah. So we were talking about like experience and Pro Tour regulars. You know, knowing how to draft, having been there, being able to transition seamlessly between Magic Online and Paper Magic, or maybe not putting in as much preparation as, you know, maybe in the case of myself and Karan, have to, in order to feel like we're fully ready and still perform and get those top results. But I think in many senses, this is the second advent of MTGO players, or just online players in general, in some cases, arena players. Showing up and starting to take over the Pro Tour. You know, there's your result, having finished 9th, and then some others like Schiavetto, I think it's Pedro Perini from Brazil. Yeah, he also had a really good result. And, you know, I'm sure you interact with a lot of these people on a daily basis, you know, with how connected we are in this day and age, and just being able to, you know, message someone directly on Magic Online or have them in a Discord chat. Do you feel the same way? Are these former pros or top players maybe not as motivated and not putting in the time they need to in order to compete at what is now a higher level? Because you guys, you know, especially in your case, you know, you play every challenge every weekend, regardless of format. you are playing the prelims. You're just at the forefront of like the tech in every format. You've played the games, you know the matchups, you know the lines. Yeah, what was it like getting to meet a lot of these people? And do you agree that in a sense, now's the time for the online players who have qualified to show how good they are, and that maybe Magic is moving to be even more competitive in this day and age?
So there was an era back in poker that you used to have all the greatest of all time, like the ones who won like the championships and everything, and then PokerStars was a big thing, and the online players moved onto the scene, and they tear everything apart. I do think this is what's happening now, more so in the case of like Nathan Stoyer or like Carl Sarap or like all these online players that have been doing really, really well at the Pro Tour. I think it's natural in a way because they are playing the most amount of Magic than anyone. They're playing, when you're in Magic Online, you play way more matches than you play in paper. So you have more experience. You're like a veteran, even though you're young. So this is what's happening now. And it's like a new era of Magic. I do think like Ray Duke winning the last Pro Tour was nice and a great moment for the game. But it's probably an exception, and now the online players are like the I guess the ones to fear the most.
To be fair, yeah, though, Reed is one of you. You know, if we're going back years, like you know, if you
It's so true. Yeah, it's so fun.
Yeah, I mean, Reed was that guy who, you know, the first, you know, if you will, going back, the Magic Online end boss who made his way and eventually became a staple on the paper scene, and then I guess years later it was Brad Nelson who did that. And I think Brad also finished ninth, just like you in his first Pro Tour, if I'm not mistaken. So, you know, that's why I thought it was a really cool moment when I saw Brad tweet something about, you know, playing some event and he's got some deck list that he got from you, or you hooked him up with some deck list like a month ago or whatever. And I thought that was like a cool moment where, like, you know, former Magic Online end boss and current Magic Online end boss come together. So, yeah, it's changing of the guard, so to speak.
Yeah, it's funny how I know these guys were like Magic Online end bosses, but I now think that those guys are the paper greats, and like they're the old guard. But yeah, it's so funny how it turns out.
Yeah, because like if you know, you go back and there's different phases, and like, you know, a few years back it was Logan Nettles, it was Jabberwocky, and before that I guess it was Budokov. You know, and it's really cool. In fact, I think the last PT I played in my draft pod, my two opponents, my first two, my second and third opponents were Dmitry Budokov and Logan Nettles. You know, so yeah, I guess that's the way of the world. Magic Online or Arena, if you will, to a lesser extent. Just on the Arena versus Magic Online, obviously the monetization aspect on MTGO is a big draw card to playing MTGO, but taking away the monetization and the fact that, you know, you can actually make money off of MTGO, what's your opinion on the two platforms and what they offer, and I guess level of competition? Because that's something that we always comes up on this pod.
I think Magic Online offers way better training for competition than Magic Arena does. When you're in Magic Online, you get to play against the best players in a challenge. Like in a challenge, you will face like, I don't know, a world champion, you know, like someone who finished, like two people who finished like top eight in the Pro Tour. Like you're playing really good players in Magic Online, and every weekend. In Magic Arena, I don't think that the ladder for most formats is that competitive. You get to see a lot of decks that are questionable, and just the way Arena works, like it has taught players to play in a different way, like sometimes skipping faces and all that weird shenanigans that I don't think it's like the best. I don't think it's like they're comparable. I think Magic Online is way better to train yourself into Magic than Magic Arena.
I think somebody made the point on this podcast previously that while Arena technically is Magic, Magic Arena almost feels like a video game, where Magic Online feels like you're playing the same paper-based game on a computer. And I think that's a good way of summing up the difference between the two environments. That being said, your point, you did say that the actual Arena Championships or the qualifications or whatever, you thought that was quite difficult, or maybe more difficult than you expected?
I still don't know how you qualify for this. Like, I'm not sure how you qualify for this. I remember, like, there was something in online, and then getting, like a qualifier weekend, and then, like, day two, and then having a score. But there are probably more ways that I'm missing.
Then you know. Okay, I get you. Yeah, it's not something we bother with historically as well. I guess we're at the end of the road now. Pro Tour is done. Will you be playing these events? So will your next event be a paper event, that is? Would you be playing in Valencia, or are you skipping that one?
Valencia? I know the next one is in Athens, the next paper. I don't know anything about Valencia.
Oh yeah, Valencia is like a, whatever they call it, like a LMS. I think it's like a new type of Grand Prix. It's not actually the regional championship. It's called LMS Valencia.
Okay, I'll like look into that. Maybe I can, I don't know when it is. Maybe I can combine it, but my plan was to just do the Athens regionals. And then, because it's in my city, I don't have to travel, and then just play the Pro Tour on Barcelona.
Yeah, and you would have to play Pioneer if you were to play the LMS GP, and you told us you're not a fan of that. If you don't mind quickly telling us about Pioneer, do you have like maybe a deck or two that you typically play or that you prefer? And if you could just give us a short reason as to why.
Yes. I think my most played deck is probably the Phoenix, the blue-red Phoenix deck. I think it's a very consistent deck that doesn't have any terrible matchups. Like people say, red-black is so good against the Phoenix, but I don't think that's the case. Like all the bad matchups are close. They're like 45, and it's like so good in open metas usually, that deck, but it might not be the case this time. So I really don't know. It's far too early for me to know what deck to play in like Athens, which is Pioneer as well.
I saw a bunch of you complaining about the venue in Athens. Apparently the venue is not great, or it's out of the way or something of that sort. Did they move it, or is that still the case?
I don't think they moved it. Like after the deal has been made, it's like too late. It's like we're just whining at this point. I don't think we could change anything. We just like talked about it. Basically, the venue is near the airport, and the like compared to other cities, the airport is like very far away from the city center, and like Athens is a great city to experience. Like it's gonna be in the summer, so everybody can go to the beach, or they can go visit like Acropolis. There's so much sightseeing to do in the city center, and like great food and everything, but near the airport. Like, all of these things are far, far away. So you probably can't match them with the days that you play. It's going to be too many hours, and then you need, like, 3 hours to go back and forth. So you're going to, like, people visiting, they will have to stay more days if they want to experience Athens. And there are venues in much better places, like near the beach, that would allow them to spend more time doing tourist stuff.
On that note, I saw your tweet in preparation for the Pro Tour. You said that you packed your bag, you had your American flag swim trunks ready to go, and your playlist was ready. What sort of music were you listening to on that plane ride over? And, you know, maybe before and after the Pro Tour, did you get up to any shenanigans? Were you able to experience some of the US besides crappy pizza?
Yes. So I visited my family. They live on the East Coast, near DC, Washington, DC. So I went to the museums. I had great food. We they grow weed. So it's we had like some very fun time. I mean, it's legal, you know. So we had some really fun time, and then in Minneapolis, I managed to do like one day, like half a day to walk around the lakes, and one day to visit the Mall of America, which is the biggest mall, and do all the consumerist stuff. It was fun.
Nice. It's funny you mentioned the weed thing, and it's so interesting because I know a lot of people in other countries, they're like, oh, weed, it's drugs, it's, you know, it's bad, or whatever the case is. And it's funny because as a South African, like, it was never officially legal here, like years gone by, but it was a normal thing. It was like, you know, like practically like smoking a cigarette. Like, you'd smell weed everywhere and you could buy it just about anywhere, but it was like always just a known thing. So it's always interesting when you hear of these other countries and they're like, oh, it's legal, it's cool, you can do these things. And you know, people would go to Amsterdam or whatever and go to those cafes and buy some joints. But as a South African, it was like never a thing because we could always just, you know, you could buy it easily accessible whenever you want from the time you were pretty much a teen. But that being said, Kalze, anything else you want to finish off with for Harris?
No, just thank you for your time, Harris. I think we learned a lot as usual, and really appreciate your time and your perspective. So wish you all the best here for the next RC. Hopefully you can crack Pioneer and maybe share some of your findings with us, because we're a bunch of mono green gamers over here for the time being, and it's kind of flippy floppy as far as the results with mono green.
Thank you for having me, guys.
Thank you, man. It's a pleasure having you here, and you know, just listening to some of your insights and the way your mind works and the way you approach things. It's you know, so unconventional, and I've learned a lot from you. And yeah, thanks for your time, man. I really appreciate it, and we're gonna be following you to see what you do next. And yeah, really looking forward to seeing you at the next, I guess, RCs and protests coming up.
Thank you, Kieran. Bye.
All the best, and we're out.